Tennessee on March 7, 1962, during her visit to Memphis.
I'm going to immediately turn the program over to Dr. Van Middlesworth, who will introduce our speaker for us at this noon hour. Dr. Van Middlesworth.
Laboratory in London, where she's been working for quite a while on the thyroid hormones. And she's really now primarily responsible for recognizing the biological importance of the derivative triiodothyronine. And this really revolutionized the whole idea of thyroid physiology. And so this, of course, was very encouraging to her. And so she got off and started investigating many derivatives of thyroxine. And many different phenomena have turned up all over the world from her original pioneer works. So Dr. Pitt Rivers, now, I don't know really why she came to Memphis, but we're awfully glad to see her. And I told her that she would be very, very welcome, and we would show a Britisher how much the South appreciates her. And so we would like now for her to give us everything she has from the fire. Thank you.
That is what happens. The next slide shows you the incorporation of I-131 into a rat thyroid at different times after a subcutaneous or intraperitoneal injection of radioactive iodine. This is expressed, these curves are expressed as percentage of the total iodine in the gland, and the data are obtained by hydrolyzing the thyroid with pancreatin and separating chromatographically the different iodoamino acids and measuring their radioactivity. As you see, the first compound to be formed and formed in large amounts is monoiodotyrosine, which is the black circle, which reaches its maximum value half an hour after the injection and thereafter falls to a steady value of about 15% in rat thyroid. As it falls, monoiodotyrosine, the open circle, rises and remains at a value of about 45 to 60%. Thyroxin, which is formed more slowly, the upright triangle in the rat again reaches a maximum of around 12 to 15%, and triiodothyronine a maximum of 3% or rather less. Very few distribution curves have been done in other species, but in those in which they have been done, at least in mammals and in most vertebrates, this distribution, the distribution of iodine in especially diiodotyrosine and thyroxin is fairly similar to this. And diiodotyrosine is the predominating compound in all samples of thyroglobulin so far investigated. Now, one of the questions that's been posed in the last few years is, where is thyroglobulin synthesized in the gland? And this has been studied mostly with the aid of I-131 and autoradiography of sections of thyroid. Some early work of LeBlanc and his colleagues at McGill University suggested that a very short time interval after iodine injection, I-131 injection, radioactive iodine could be located in the cells of the thyroid follicle. But neither Dr. LeBlanc nor anyone else has confirmed this finding, and more recent evidence shows that even after very short time intervals, half a minute or less, after I-131 intravenous injection, you can only find organic I-131 in the lumen of the follicle, that is, in the colloid. This is shown in the next slide. This, I'm sorry, isn't a very good picture. It's just too blown up, so it looks very nice in the journal, in endocrinology, but it doesn't look so good as a Lancet slide. But in fact, it represents the follicle. You see, this is 50 in a mouse. You see the cells surrounding the lumen. You see the great darkening just within the lumen in a sort of half moon or three-quarter moon, which is, which represents the autoradiograph of the organic I-131. And in this picture, you can't tell that, I'm afraid, by looking at the slide, but in fact, if you look at the photograph, there's no evidence of any silver granules or I-131 in the cells. So now, we all say on the strength of this, it appears that thyroglobulin or pre-thyroglobulin is iodinated within the lumen of the follicle. But again, I think from a physiological point of view, that doesn't quite make sense. For one thing, homogenates of thyroid are pretty inactive. They don't want to incorporate I-131 in organic linkage, and if they succeed in doing so, do not achieve thyroid hormone synthesis. They don't go further than monoiodotyrosine. minces, thyroid minces are pretty ineffectual. So that I think we may say, in order to get a physiological representation of what goes on in the animal in vivo when the thyroid takes up iodine, you've got to have a certain degree of structural integrity in the system that you are examining in vitro. Could I have the next slide? If I turn my back to this machine, am I totally inaudible? Just about. Okay. Well, I'll have to have eyes in the back of my head. This scheme merely represents what is necessary, I think, what is a representative picture of what goes on in the thyroid and where it goes on. The iodide comes in from the blood compartment and is concentrated through the cell. Undoubtedly, the iodide trap or pump is from one side of the cell to the other. As soon as it gets to the apical side of the cell, it becomes bound. At which side of this membrane, we don't know, though I think it probably is within the cell structure. And I've specially put this formation of thyroglobulin in the middle between the cell and the colloid, because I think that that's its essential site of formation. The thyroglobulin is then passes into the lumen of the follicle, into the colloid, probably by diffusion, and eventually is hydrolyzed by the thyroid protease to give you the iodothyroxine and the iodothyronine. These last two are secreted for the most part, if not entirely, into the circulation, where they become the circulating thyroid hormones. The iodothyroxine do not pass into the circulation except in certain pathological conditions or abnormal conditions, as after radiation damage to the thyroid or in Hashimoto's thyroiditis or other such states. These iodothyroxines are deiodinated, and the iodide thus formed either diffuses out of the gland or re-enters the biosynthetic cycle. Well, now, the iodide that is formed by this deiodination, I'm not going into the story, it's one that we've investigated quite recently in my lab. And this iodide, obtained by deiodination, is a really quite considerable pool. It probably represents, as others have said before, a means of economizing iodine in the thyroid and in the body. Now, when the hormone leaves the thyroid and enter the blood, there's a very powerful transport mechanism that takes them to the peripheral target organs. If anybody here has ever worked with thyroxine, they would know that it's one of the most insoluble organic compounds of biological origin, and in fact, if there weren't proteins circulating in the blood, it would just sit on the arteriole of venous walls as it does on the edge of a glass test tube. Next slide, please. Skip that one. Proteins that occur in serum were first demonstrated really by Trevorrow by a co-precipitation method, but have been extensively investigated both in this country and to some extent in England by using electrophoretic techniques. Now, the top two strips on this picture represent the electrophoretic pattern of the blood from a thyroid cancer patient who had been given I-131 in a therapeutic dose. The very topmost strip is the paper itself, which has been stained to reveal the bands of protein. And the next strip below it shows the autoradiograph, and you see that the flattening where the thyroid hormone is located, the circulating hormone, is behind albumin in the inter-alpha globulin region. The next pair of strips represent normal serum. Well, by normal, I mean it has been labeled. Normal serum to which I-131 labeled thyroxine has been added. And again, you see that the labeled thyroxine, which we can now say is thyroxine, the first one that's a hormone, goes to exactly the same place on the electrophoretic, on the paper strip. The one below that merely shows that if thyroxine is electrophoresed on paper in the absence of protein, it does not move from the origin. Now this, which is now called thyroxine-binding globulin, is the principal transport mechanism for thyroid hormone in the blood, though other proteins have been described which are able to bind thyroxine. But these are quantitatively a good deal less important than thyroxine-binding globulin, or TBG. Triiodothyronine itself is much less firmly bound to the thyroxine-binding protein of serum. It's been thought, perhaps, that this accounts, well, it probably accounts for its more rapid disappearance in the body, and possibly for its greater activity, of which I shall speak later. Now, most of you probably know the more important, or perhaps all the actions of thyroid hormone. In the young animal, the young mammal, or in animals which differentiate, such as the amphibia, thyroid hormone is of vital importance in the processes of growth, in bone and tooth development, in the growth of hair, wool, and feathers, in protein synthesis, in nitrogen and calcium metabolism, and in electrolyte and water balance. Could I have the next slide, please? That's what comes in not turning around. I thought we had that one. Did we not have that one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's all right. You must have wondered what I... Could I have the next slide? That's what comes in not turning around. I thought we had that one. Did we not have that one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's all right. You must have wondered what I was talking about. We've had that one too. This is just a table of the more important actions in which thyroid hormones are involved. Now, in growth and in metamorphosis, I think the great importance of protein synthesis is shown in the metamorphosis of amphibia. As you know, amphibian larvae cannot become frogs or toads in the absence of thyroid hormone. And during this process of metamorphosis, new protein is synthesized at a very great rate. This is reflected in the appearance of limb buds, and also in the appearance of a completely new serum protein. Frieden has shown that the tadpole serum does not contain albumin at all. But during metamorphosis, this protein appears as a new protein in the frog's, the small frog's blood. As far as adults are concerned, I suppose the most common reflection of thyroid hormone action is the maintenance of the basal metabolic rate. In the hypothyroid patient, this is lowered. In the hyperthyroid patient, it's raised. at this stage, I think something should be said about the differences in action of the two thyroid hormones, thyroxine and triiodopyrenine. I've called those two thyroid hormones because other iodopyrenines that have been found in the thyroid in small amounts are biologically inactive and therefore don't come under the definition of hormones. We'll stick to thyroxine, which is the principal hormone, and triiodopyrenine, which is quantitatively much less important. Could I have the next slide, please? Now, if you have a thyroxine for this patient, intravenously or any other way, you all know that however hypothyroid the patient is, the BMR will not immediately rise after administration of thyroxine. Some of the effects of the hormone are fairly rapid, such as diuresis, but the rising metabolic rate has a definite latent period of action. And with thyroxine, the action of the drug, even in one dose, is fairly prolonged. If you give triiodopyrenine to a similar patient, in fact, this is the same patient, in an equimolecular dose, the effect on the BMR, although it has a latent period of action, this latent period is much shorter. The effect is much more dramatic. As you see from the dotted line, the BMR goes up with triiodopyrenine very rapidly, but also falls very rapidly. Now, this difference, difference in the apparent effects of triiodopyrenine from that of thyroxine led to the suggestion that the two hormones perhaps might have differential effects on different manifestations of thyroid activity. And it also led to the suggestion that perhaps thyroxine itself was not active until it had been converted to triiodopyrenine. Jack Rose and I were responsible for this in a rather tentative hypothetical remark in 1953, which was absolutely jumped upon and converted to an established fact. And in fact, in 1959, when I was at the National Institutes of Health, I picked up a new book in physiology on the library table and read the astonishing statement that thyroxine is no longer believed to be the thyroid hormone without any bibliography. It really makes me shiver rather to think that a remark that was merely meant as a sort of, well, it was thrown out as a challenge, has now become an established fact in a textbook. And one wonders how long it's going to take to get it out of the textbook. I think it's going to be more than my lifetime. This is a popular idea. Thyroxine is not active. It has to be deiodinated or partially deiodinated to triiodopyrenine before anything happens. Now, there are very serious objections to this hypothesis. The first is that injection or administration of labeled thyroxine to a completely athyrotic subject has not unequivocally shown the presence of triiodopyrenine in any tissues, excreta, secretions like bile or anything else. In other words, in the absence of the thyroid, you do not appear to get triiodopyrenine peripherally from thyroxine. Now the second thing is that if you inject labeled thyroxine and labeled triiodopyrenine disappears from the body much more rapidly than thyroxine. Therefore, it means but your precursor is always there, or more or less, or is there always, while your product, if triiodothiamine is a product, is disappearing. And I don't think that this is a reasonable mechanism. I don't think that a compound which is more rapidly deiodinated, which means deactivated or disactivated, is likely to be the compound that acts as the periphery. Another thing is that Dr. Rawl and I found that a considerable amount of triiodothiamine is secreted from the thyroid, at least of the rat. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily to postulate the conversion of an inactive thyroxine to an active triiodothiamine at the periphery. It makes the whole thing rather redundant. Well, now, so much for triiodothiamine being the active form of the thyroid hormone. I think we've disposed of that one, and we've got some more to dispose of. It was shown some years ago that the acetic acid analogues of the thyroid hormones, and particularly of triiodothiamine, that is now called TRIAC, had an immediate action on the oxidation of excised tissues of animals in vitro. This was shown by Madame Thibault in Paris and myself. It's not been repeated except in a very few instances. It caused a good deal of excitement. Yes, the acetic acids were the peripherally active forms of the thyroid hormones, and in fact, both the amino acid forms, thyroxine and triiodothiamine, had to be oxidatively deaminated and decarboxylated to give you the peripheral hormone. Well, this one's gone by the board too, for several reasons. As I say, the immediate effect has not been demonstrated. Another thing is that these acetic acids are very rapidly metabolized peripherally. The third is that if you have a hypothyroid subject and give them either thyroxine and either triiodothiamine or TRIAC, the latent period of action is the same. Now, it shouldn't be. If you give the active form, it should have a shorter latent period of action. But in fact, TRIAC and T3 have the same latent period. So that there's no reason for this to suppose that one is converted to the other. A few rather half-hearted claims of peripheral hormones have been made for the conjugates of the thyroid hormones, the glucuronide and the sulfate esters, which are formed in the liver. But I see no reason to think of these as anything but detoxification products. We know that phenols are conjugated in the liver. The thyroid hormones are phenols, and I think that a small amount of them undergo this natural detoxification process, but that it is not on the way to become an active form. At the present time, in view of what evidence we have, I feel convinced that thyroxine and thyroidothyronine are the thyroid hormones. They are active in themselves without having to be converted to anything else. And these metabolic products, like the acetic acid analogs, which undoubtedly exist, they've been found in tissue, they're metabolites, they're not peripheral forms of hormones. Undoubtedly they're active. They're active because they have this very peculiar structure of an iodinated diphenyl ether. And so that on some target organ, the difference of the side chain may not completely do away with the apparent biological activity of the whole compound. They're active, but they're not the hormones. I really feel I can't say this from my point of view too emphatically. I sometimes feel so strongly about it that I'd like to say, let's forget triiodothiamine and concentrate on thyroxine as certainly the sex hormones quantitatively and was forgiven all the pictures of overall thyroid hormones.